it's a delight to be talking to Peter Loizos, who was, I think, in many ways my closest friend when I was doing the MPhil in anthropology for 2 years at the LSE, certainly the person I've remained emotionally in memory of. And we're just going to talk on the 14th of September 2002, just before Peter disappears somewhere else. Peter, tell me something about your parents, if you want to, or your childhood, insofar as it influenced you as an anthropologist.
Well, my own personal theory is that most anthropologists of my generation and older, you could identify social marginality of one kind or another as related to why they became anthropologists. But then I'm not actually sure about that, because when I think about my theory of marginality, it's a pretty soft one, and perhaps everybody under these rubrics would turn out to be marginal. So, but if you think about it, my own case, right. My mother was from a Scots-Irish family in South London. Her father had been born and brought up in Ireland. His surname was Ahern, and he ran away to join the army to fight in the Boer War, when lied about his age, said he was older than he was, eventually became a regimental sergeant major, and was apparently an authoritarian and unpleasant man in many respects. So my mother was one of four children and grew up under his shadow, I think, with a great deal of hostility to him. My mother's memories of a childhood involve wishing to read books and being told by her mother to put that bloody book down and, you know, do the cooking or the shopping or the tidying. So my mother always was a passionate reader of anything she'd get her hands on. She left school at 12 to work in a pepper factory and eventually managed to get sort of white-collar jobs. She was a beautiful woman, and she could get jobs as sales assistants in retailing. And, you know, she also managed to hold down jobs later in life as the manageress of small hotels. She also worked as a typist in the civil service. And so she did many things. Now, one of the things she did was to meet my father in about 1930. I think she was working in a kiosk on either on Victoria Station or near it, and my father, I think, had very recently got off the boat from Cyprus, having gone into a kind of self-exile of embarrassment, because he felt he'd compromised his beliefs as a young communist. That's another story, but my father saw an attractive English girl reading a book, and the book was by Bernard Shaw, and he therefore decided to be very bold and speak to her, and so on. So that was 1930. I was born in 1937. My parents did not stay together very long, so I was brought up by my mother with a good deal of support from her brothers and sister and brother-in-law. So my father disappeared into the RAF and basically disappeared from our view for many years. So fast forward to me at school, I discover that at the age of 11, I wrote my name in the Greek alphabet, and it was a much longer Greek name than I was baptized Papaloizou, a five-syllable name meaning son of the priest Louis, Louisos. And indeed, my grandfather was a village priest, although I never knew him. So I believe that somehow in my childhood I had to explain why I had a long Greek name but appeared to be English in other respects. I mean, spoke English, didn't look very foreign. Why I didn't have a father. The war was a useful cover until the end of the war, but I couldn't produce a plausible dead hero. He was missing, but I mean, the reason he was missing was not the reason that a child would be given to understand. So gradually the picture began to clarify. I finally realized when I was about 12 that my father was alive, my mother had divorced him. I had a very unsatisfactory meeting with him in Brixton Public Library and didn't wish to repeat that experience, much to my mother's satisfaction, for many years. But there was some need to explain to other children and teachers why one had this kind of link to Greekness, but nothing to show for it. I couldn't speak the language, I couldn't produce a Greek father. So I think that explains me writing my name in the Greek alphabet. It explains me deciding to study classics, which I wasn't very good at Dulwich, so I did classical Greek and Latin to O level. And I think, you know, I remember in my first form at Dulwich having a classics teacher who referred to me as a Greek tragedy. I mean, he made a mock of me, and I hated that, as any child would. And I think there's a sense in which a great deal of what I've done with the relation to Greekness and Cypriotness could be a kind of settling accounts with David Vivian Knight, a squash blue and a brilliant fly half, but a totally inadequate teacher of small boys. Anyway, this will go on and on, but I mean, somehow, get me to age 29, I've met my father a few more times, my mother is dead, I'm stressed by continuing to work as a television documentary filmmaker. I've lived in America for 4 years.
You missed out on undergraduate.
Oh, well, I went, you know, I was strongly encouraged by Inglit people at Cambridge, at Dulwich, and ended up going to Cambridge and reading English literature. Halfway through English literature, I thought I might want to study anthropology. I got a couple of friends who were reading anthropology. It sounded interesting. I went to discuss this with a relevant person in my college, but he put me off because it became clear I would have to do 4 years. I wouldn't have a grant for the fourth year. And he didn't actually seem, he was more interested in an inappropriate relationship than he was in my academic future. So that guy sort of left that. And it was a fairly frivolous interest. It wasn't based on any real knowledge. But I did end up at Cambridge reading William Foote White's Street Corner Society because I felt I wanted to know more about social science, and sociology was the thing which in Cambridge 1958-59, if you were a bright young art student who was vaguely disaffected by your degree, you took a great interest in sociology. And as Cambridge University didn't have sociology, it became sort of forbidden fruit. So there was a sort of student grumbling movement about why doesn't Cambridge have sociology and so on. Mm. So there was that.
You were at the time at Leavis, weren't you?
I was at Leavis and was for a while fascinated by Leavis, but became unfascinated when I discovered the man was not capable of any kind of spontaneity. That if you tried to have a conversation with Leavis about any literary figure that you'd become interested in, it was like pressing a button and getting the received text, and his eyes would glaze over, and it would be as if he was reading you something he'd written, and he was reciting something he'd written. He had an opinion, here it was. I remember asking him what he thought about Wyndham Lewis, and he started swaying from side to side, saying, "Oh, the cult of Wyndham Lewis." Yes. And then he did a thorough demolition of how superficial and trendy and hopeless Wyndham Lewis was. He seemed to want to kill so much off that I didn't feel he was someone I wanted to stay in intellectual company on. I then got Donald Davey as a tutor, who was absolutely brilliant, and advised me not to do a PhD in Englit at Cambridge because their theory of what a PhD was about was such a tedious and boring one. Mm. So I was glad to get permission to escape from literature, because you know what happens, that if students admire their teachers too much, they feel they ought to go on in what the teacher does. And Donald very shrewdly gave me permission to go.
It was a glitch, as they say, a glittering period in Cambridge at that time. It was the time when many of those great footlights sort of characters.
Oh yeah, they were all, yes, yes. They were all around. I could reminisce about some of them for hours.
But anyway, you left. You went. You got a 2-1.
No, of course not. I got a first.
You got two. A first.
I got firsts in both parts of the tripod.
There you are.
You
put on the record.
And I was very pleased to have done it. But the only reason that happened was because at the end of prelims, I was very close to a 2-2, and my tutor, John Crook, who was a classicist, called me in and said, "Peter, you know, we gave you an exhibition and we thought you were a rather bright chap, and you don't seem to have done much work this year, and it's rather a pity, you know." I mean, he was very gentle, but he was very clear that I had disappointed him and the college. And
which
no
college was it?
St. John's. And no one had ever been that disappointed with me except my maths teachers. So I came back resolved to work properly, and I've found as a teacher occasionally that you can pull, it's usually young men, sometimes young women, you can kind of turn them around by having that conversation and saying, "You know, you could be doing rather better. And there must be people who have hopes from you." So anyway,
when you went down,
I went on a fellowship to Harvard called the Knox Fellowship. But the other things I was thinking about were going to a film school, but there was one in Uch in Poland, but it would have taken 7 years and had to learn Polish, and one would have had to live on bread and cheese. The other was to go to work with Ivor Winters in Stanford, California, who had a reputation for bringing on young poets, and Tom Gunn had gone and worked with him, and I sent him some poems, and Winters wrote back and said that my poems had the sort of faults of my generation in Britain, the so-called New Movement, but he thought he could cure me of them. So if I wanted to come, they would give me an assistantship. But I was much influenced by a girlfriend who was doing a PhD in criminology, that poetry was frivolous and that I should really become a social scientist. So. Cherchez la femme, yeah. So I did go to Harvard. I did a year of introductory social science in the social relations department under Parsons' benign, you know, governance. I did introductory courses in psychology, sociology, anthropology. I can't remember what the fourth course was, perhaps criminology. I was taught by absolutely wonderful teachers. George Caspar Hermans, I took a course from, David McClelland, Robert Rappaport, Stanton Wheeler was a criminology teacher. I sat in on a course of lectures by, six development paths to modernity. He's a historian, comparative sociological historian, who tries to explain big transitions. I'm sure he's Anyway, he was a brilliant lecturer too. Barrington Moore, that's the name I'm looking for. I'm sure. Social origins of dictatorship and democracy, right? And, you know, he was teaching, he was making us read Marx and take Marx seriously. And I did go off and read some Marx. I thought Marx was, you know, a very powerful analyst. The 13th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, I think, is one of the texts I read for Barrington Moore. So the decision was go on at Harvard, and that was perfectly possible. They offered me some tutorship there. But I was by now becoming a sort of dropout. I decided that I'd worked so hard at Cambridge and that Harvard Graduate School was full of people who were going to go on working that hard for the foreseeable future, and that life was going to be a bloody grind. And I didn't like that. I wanted more fun. And I got involved with film. I mean, the girlfriend in England had been a tremendous cineast, and we'd gone to a lot of very interesting films in Cambridge. And I kind of went on with film in Harvard, going to films. And then I was walking past the Peabody Museum of Anthropology one day when I saw a little sign that said Film Study Center. Film study, that sounds really interesting. And I went down into a basement, and there was a very tall, elegant Bostonian called Robert Gardner, a descendant of Isabella Stewart Gardner and the Peabody Museum. And Gardner was kind of distant and cool at first, but when he sort of heard who I was and what I was doing, was inclined to be a little warmer, and finally agreed to let me do a reading course, as they call it at Harvard, in which he would direct my reading about film. I duly went and told Talcott Parsons that I was dropping the stats course, which he was very disapproving of, because I was hopeless at stats, and that I wanted to do this reading course with Gardner on film. And clearly Parsons was uneasy about this, but he said, you Knox fellows are allowed to do what you want. So, I mean, you're not actually registered for the PhD yet, so if you want, as it were, waste your time like that, I can't stop you. But there was, so I went to Gardner, and Gardner made me read a very difficult book first on photochemistry of cinema, and, you know, and I ground through this difficult book. But then I'd read it, Spottiswood, I think it was. And then he gave me a much more interesting book by Krakauer to read. Siegfried Krakauer had written a new book on realism and the cinema. And I was very excited by that. And after about 2 months of me reading like a lunatic for Gardner, he finally said, well, all this reading, I mean, it's time you did some filming. And he gave me a 16mm camera and some outdated stock and said, you'd better learn how to load that and shoot it. And there's a guy there called Timothy Ash who might help you. And so I went and shot some film, and not very much, not very good, but it got me interested and more interested. So the next 5 years were an obsession with with cinema. I wanted to get to be a sort of Irish Greek Cypriot Ingmar Bergman or Federico Fellini, but I ended up at the BBC in documentary and in a science framework, which wasn't where to go. You know, I find every step I took was a step in the wrong direction. If I had to live my life over again, I would have got on the motorbike, driven to Hollywood, slept outside John Huston's apartment until I was either removed or he gave me a job. You know, I mean, that's what I should have done. But I didn't have the self-confidence to do that. And if you ask for a sort of theme in my life, it is always that I'm always attached to well-funded institutions that will kind of guarantee me no financial hardship. And I think financial hardship was a theme in my mother. Single parents were pretty unusual, and it was the war, and money was very tight. It went on being tight until I was old enough to earn some. I started earning at 16, and I never stopped. I mean, I always had a job every vacation from then on. So, I mean, I'm not a risk taker. I am a satisficer.
BBC experience must have been very technically useful. I mean, it taught you how to make films and edit films and...
Yeah, but the kind of filming I wanted to do was that which Tim Ash was doing, where you shot the camera yourself. I mean, but I was recruited into the BBC as an assistant director, and the unionisation of broadcasting then was such that I couldn't actually physically touch the camera in any form. I mean, a cameraman operated a camera, directors directed, and there was no pathway in which you could have done what you are now doing, which is operating a camera yourself for your own purposes. I'd have had to go in as a technical trainee, and it's the old officers and other ranks distinction.
Mm.
Yeah, it's pilots and tail gunners and things.
Yes. So you were an officer.
I was deemed to be an officer. And after a few years of that, I decided the television I was doing was intellectually unsatisfying. And I wandered back to reading anthropology books, and I sat in the British Museum for some weeks reading anthropology. And then I decided to go and see someone at the LSE, and I met Raymond Firth, who was quite very welcoming, you know. And he just had David Attenborough through the department, and he'd begun to think that you know, he could sort of have these BBC people in and out and turn them into anthropologists and things.
Mm.
So he was very nice to me, and I was probably earning not much less than he was at the time because of the disparities.
Mm.
And he was very interested. I was prepared to walk away from that.
Mm.
So...
This is 1966.
Yeah. And I went... And in the British Museum, I'd read an essay by E.P. which suggested it took 10 years to turn someone from a student of anthropology into an anthropologist. And I said to Firth, I'm not sure I can make... 10 years is such a long time. I've got to do something before then, you know. And Firth was very good. He just smiled and he said, that's E.P. laying it on a bit thick. You can actually... It's safe to say that you could have something worth saying in half that time. So I thought, 5 years, all right. This was a repetition of something that at Dulwich, I thought for a while of becoming a doctor, and then I discovered that I'd gone up the wrong path, that if you'd done classics to A-level, in order to become a doctor, you'd have to kind of go back down the snake and start a lot of science courses, and I was probably no good at them, and it would add years and years. So I, you know, for two weeks, I passionately wanted to train in medicine, and it looked like I'd just gone the wrong route. So I mean, life seems to be a series of false starts until you actually find what you're going to do. And funny thing is, I'm now in the position where I am going to engage with medical matters, but as a social scientist. So it's a bit late in life that is joining up.
Mm. So why LSE? I mean, it's just convenient in London.
I think it was the only name I knew where you could do anthropology in London. I wouldn't have known about UCL or SOAS.
I remember asking you why you'd left the BBC. I still remember your answer. You said, well, you can only say no a certain number of times.
It's true. Yeah. They kept asking me to do things I thought was trivial or superficial, and it was the wrong attitude. Your attitude was supposed to be, yes, of course, Chris Brasher, or yes, of course, Gordon Rattray Taylor, or Aubrey Singer, I'll do it with enthusiasm, and come back with your tail in the air. And I found some of the stuff they wanted me to do extremely depressing. And other people could do it and just laugh. And they'd say, oh, come on, you know, you'll do something else next week. Just get on with it. But I would fall in some sort of existential gloom about the impossibility of making an interesting film about ladies arranging flowers, not realizing that the ethos of television was to make programs, not works of art. And you've got your mind in the wrong gear. If I'd had my mind in a journalistic churn it out mode, I'd have been all right. But as the place I wanted to get to was creative filmmaking.
Mm.
Every 5 minute story on flower arranging was a kind of crucifixion. Sorry.
Fine. Okay. Okay, so we've now got to the point where we met. Are there any... it'd be fascinating to hear, I mean, it's only a small part of both our life, but we were both at the LSE doing the MPhil for 2 years.
That's right.
Is there anything that you particularly recall from that experience?
Well, I recall that you were rather terrifying because you'd already done your PhD in history and you knew much more about how to attack a problem and lay it out than I did or anybody else in our group did. We were all learning on, you know, for the first time, and you kept turning up with sets of notes about how to tackle a problem that seemed to me amazingly systematic. So you were a bit intimidating. And the departmental secretary, who was a rather formidable lady called Gladys Rice, could be heard to say, bloody Alan McFarlane, what does he want 2 PhDs for? Isn't one enough? We tried to explain to Gladys that it was a perfectly sensible thing to do, to specialise in a second discipline. But anyway, so there was that. What else? What I remember is that the first 6 weeks or 2 months of trying to study anthropology was painful in the extreme, because not only had I not been reading intensively in that way for some years, at least 5 years since I'd left Harvard, but that there seemed to be this formidable jargon which it was very hard. You know, they didn't give you definitions. They started to use words that clearly were resonant and technical. And you couldn't quite find out what they meant. And even if you could, you didn't have much content for the words. So I remember it as being a very painful and difficult learning experience. And then suddenly one had kind of passed through it. And I wrote, I mean, for some reason, I wrote lots and lots of difficult kinship essays. I think Anthony Forge had the idea that kinship was pretty important and that writing essays about kinship was very good for my development. So I went off into cross-cousin marriage and I read lots and lots and lots. And why I had managed to do well at Cambridge and why I could do this conversion course is that when I get stuck into a topic, I can work tremendously hard for a week and read masses of stuff and then write an essay on the sixth or seventh day. Because of journalistic abilities, that is quite orderly and literate. So, I mean, the essays piled up, but it was an awful lot of kinship.
Mm. Anthony was your supervisor?
Yes, and I admired him because he was... informal, friendly, smiley, inclined to take you off for a drink. Mm. And the drink, I mean, later it would sort of become the whole evening, sort of eat in restaurants and meet his wife. And, you know, Anthony was very sociable, probably to the detriment of his own work, because I think he did more of that than was good for him in scholarly terms.
Was there anyone else there?
In the teachers?
Yeah, Robin Fox.
Robin Fox was there and was also, because he knew me from another context, he was inclined to treat me like a grown-up, the context being the ethology seminars in the London Zoo. And I, at the time, I was married to a woman who was studying chimpanzees in the London Zoo, Caroline, then Medawar, now Garland.
The daughter of the famous,
yeah. So I'd met Robin in those seminars and knew he was exciting to ethologists because he was open to biology in a way that most British social anthropologists are not. And he didn't stay very long. He was off to America. Mm. Who else was there? At the time on the staff, there was Suti Ortiz, who was also very positive to people like me, or certainly to me. There was Burton Benedict, who was a warm, competent scholar. There was Stephen Morris, who was rather shy and quiet, but gave very clear lectures. It was Morris Friedman with whom I felt something in common with Morris, and I think it's the combination of humble social origins and ethnic difference. And Morris allowed me to relate to him in that way. He would say to me at various times, he would make ironic comments about people of middle class and privileged origins who didn't understand features of the real world because they'd had life too easy. So, I mean, there was that sort of private space. So all that was going on. Firth in the background. Lucy was teaching. Lucy was around. There was a dreadful seminar that we were forced to go to. I mean, it was probably very good for us, but at the time, I think most of us resented it. And it was run jointly by Isaac Shapira, Percy Cohen, Lucy Nair. And it was the last joint activity between sociology and anthropology. And it was therefore a comparative seminar. And they picked some kind of marriage theme for one term. Endogamy, was it? And Shap caught me in the corridor and he said, "Mr. Loizos, Greek-Turkish intermarriage." I said, "Shap, there isn't any." He said, "Greek-Turkish intermarriage." And he said a date, and that was it. I had to produce a paper on this topic by that date. And I was furiously angry with him because I was trying to prepare to go to Cyprus and read lots of other background stuff. And I thought this will be... I didn't see it as an opportunity. I saw it as a distraction. Now, in fact, I wrote that seminar paper and I did quite a lot of work for it and I learned quite a lot by doing it. And when I gave the paper, it was taken quite seriously there. People thought, I'd found something potentially a little bit interesting. Audrey Haley gave a paper in that seminar, and I asked her a question about it, and then she didn't sort of take the point that I was making, and I was a bit disappointed because I thought, I kind of liked her persona. She was rather attractive and, stylish. And so I went away with my tail between my legs, but then I got a note from her a week later that said, after the seminar, I thought about what you said, and I actually think that's quite an interesting point, so I want you kind of to know that I've been thinking about it. So then I felt much better again, I remember Lucy in that seminar, and I fear it was something I said, but it may have been something somebody else said. One of us said something she thought was wrong, and she said with great passion, "Rubbish, rubbish, rubbish!" This was devastating. And she, of course, had no idea she was being devastating. She was treating us like grown-ups. But we didn't appreciate that she would have said the same thing to Shap or, So I think that seminar was more of a learning situation than we appreciated at the time. I experienced it as a coercive situation, and so did several of my age mates. We sort of grumbled about it. We were being dragooned, we felt. And there was the idea that we could be consulted about what we wanted to do rather than dragooned.
What about Raymond's seminar, which we both attended? I can't remember whether it was for 2 years, but we certainly did in the last year.
Yeah.
Because Alfie Gell describes how he used to sort of say, "Now, Mr. Loizos, would you like to comment?" I remember him as actually going round the table.
He did. He'd go round the table systematically, and my memory is, if you felt for some reason at that point you couldn't comment, you were just about allowed to say once, not at this point, but you were very sure he'd come back to you, and that you had better have something to say the second time. You had not to be so dull or inattentive as to say twice that it was some, it would be shameful. And Raymond was writing it all down in three colours of ink and producing his summaries at the end. And I found his summaries illuminating. But Maurice Bloch claims that Raymond's summaries always completely misrepresented the points that had been made. So, I mean, there you have the difference, a difference. I think Maurice is wrong on this because Raymond is tremendously careful in summarising and, you know, and he's very descriptive and sort of organised. So I can't imagine he would have...
I think I would have noticed.
He wasn't in the passion of strong contrary ideas. He wasn't in the grip of... You know, he didn't have an agenda he was trying to force on us. He was trying to educate us and make us think.
I remember one particular occasion which led me to admire him more and more, which was that for a term or two there was a visitor attending them, Cyril Belshaw.
I know the name, yeah.
And he obviously came from a different kind of style of seminar, because when people said things which weren't very clever, he would jump on them and say, you know, that's a stupid remark and you had no experience and so on. And Raymond, you know, turned to him and said, that's not the way we run seminars here. You know, people can say what they feel, and if it isn't something you agree with, then that's...
Well, good for Raymond.
Yeah, I thought that was great.
Where was Belshaw from?
He wrote about Melanesia or something. I think he was from Australia. He was on visiting job from Australia, but I particularly remember that moment. Anyway, we did the 2 years. With other people like David Seddon and Andrew Turton and David Turton and all these other people who went on into anthropology. And then I went off to SOAS and you went on to do your PhD.
In Cyprus.
Yeah.
Yes, and one of the things we did in that seminar, and I think you, this was your idea, we created what we called the Cooler Ring, which
That's
was
right.
a system of reports from the field.
That's right.
And I did one, and you did one, and one or two other people did one, and then somehow I think it petered out.
Yes, but it went through my mother in the Outer Hebrides, and communications probably faltered a bit, but... You know, there's only a certain amount you could do, but for about a year or two, we kept in touch through that.
Yeah, it was a good idea, and I think nowadays, of course, they have more high-tech means. I mean, in an age of email and...
A lot of them do correspond, yes.
Yeah.
So, Cyprus fieldwork.
Did you visit Cyprus while I was in the field? A number of people did. I mean, it felt like an international crossroads sometimes. I mean, David Turton, Andrew Turton visited me. Andrew Roberts, the East African historian, visited. A guy called John Bailey, who was involved in conflict research in Northern Ireland and Cyprus, visited. So I began to feel, and a drunken journalist friend of mine visited on his way back from the Vietnam War, and I sometimes felt too exposed. I couldn't sort of get on with my research without people turning up. It's the hazard. I mean, you in Nepal would not be subjected to such problems.
Yeah, the opposite problem there.
Yeah.
So the theme was...
Well, it was supposed to be... the thing I got interested in was stratification and marriage and... the extent to which people were marrying equals or marrying, trying to marry up, and how this was different for men and women, and how far there was a sort of class coherence in marriage patterns. And I was much influenced by an American comparative family sociologist called William Good, who'd written several major comparative studies. And while I was in the field, I wrote him a long letter about what I was finding and how far it supported his arguments and how far it was different from them. I got back an immensely engaging letter, and he actually started off by saying really important things have to be responded to straight away. So he made it feel that he'd set things aside in order to respond to this letter, and he went through everything point by point, and he had many suggestions And I was absolutely delighted to get that response. And of course, one doesn't always get that from one supervisor. And
that's marvellous. Actually, I had a letter from him too, because later I won the William J. Good Prize for a book, and I got a very nice personal letter from him saying how delighted he was and personally delighted and so on. Really nice. So
yeah. Yes, we did indeed. My research, I mean, I felt after 3 or 4 months that I understood some of the issues. I'd gone to the field to study on marriage and dowry, and I went on doing systematic work on that because I planned to do a census at the end of the field work, and I did a census interviewing 200 male household heads, which allowed me to get some of the detail I really needed. But what became apparent during my fieldwork was that politics was much more volatile and fundamental than I had understood on my previous social visit to Cyprus. Bear in mind that between my first visit to Cyprus for personal engagement with my father's village and my never-met relatives in 66, and my arrival in the field for the first time in 68, a military coup occurred in Greece, April 21st, 1967, a date indelible in my memory, and the authoritarian nature of that government extended into political life in the village, so that people were taking positions for and against the dictatorship, and people were watching each other's political preferences and bearing tales and carrying notes, and names were being recorded in files. And when the day came in 1974 for a military coup in Cyprus, they had the lists of opponents ready to round up. So, I mean, they went systematically village to village, knocking on particular houses to bring out the people they thought most likely to oppose them. So that was the big cloud over my fieldwork. I mean, I'd gone there to enjoy an engagement with, you know, an exotic culture as I saw it, and settle my accounts with my father and my long Greek name at the same time. And that was all fine. I mean, I got a tremendously warm and supportive response from my many relatives. But the politics was the snake in Eden, if you like, the serpent. And the politics became a hot and dangerous politics. I mean, while I was doing my field work, a number of young men were arrested in connection with an attempted assassination of the chief of police. There were several assassinations on Makarios during this period. I mean, the whole place was rife with political tension. There were roadblocks outside all the Turkish villages. There were armed men everywhere you went. And in Nicosia at night, people would fire hundreds of rounds for no particular reason. But I mean, every night there would be heavy machine gun fire in Nicosia, just young men showing their opposition to each other. So it was a funny time to be in the field, but other people were having even more difficult times. I mean, Andrew Turton got pretty close to being bombed in Thailand, I believe.
This wasn't the time you made a film. You did that later.
I did the film after I'd kind of finished a PhD. Mm. I'm a one thing at a time person, if possible. So,
because that was more to do with land and
I tried to persuade Raymond that before going to Cyprus, there was a guy called Martin Nettleship knocking around the department who'd worked in Taiwan with the Atayal people. And Martin and I got friendly, and we cooked up a scheme to go and make a film about the Atayal. But Raymond looked at the proposal we'd written and were going to send to Werner Gren. He gave his opinion that this was a distraction from what I should be doing, and that know, although it was all very fine in principle, and he had nothing against films, and indeed thought films were a good thing to be doing, he was kind of pointing out that I was zigzagging, I think. And so I mean, we didn't get The Mummy, I think, and I dropped that idea.
What date was this? This was about
67, I think. Yeah, it was before I'd gone to the field. That was the problem. And, Anthony Forge had been shooting film in Melanesia as well. And Avian Lewis had been shooting some film. So there was a feeling around the department that film was one of the coming things and that the department was in there. And James Woodburn, of course. Had,
yes.
So, you know, there was a sense in which I was the right person at the right time in that department.
You mentioned, I know you've spent an awful lot of time on Raymond Burke in various ways, you've interviewed him and so on, but one thing that was notable about the obituaries, he died recently, was that they didn't have that passionate warmth which you have about someone like Alpha Gel who dies in the middle of their career. He was now having obituaries written by people who were 40 years younger than himself. And it was very difficult to say, except you know, that he's terribly distinguished and he'd done a huge amount of anthropology and so on. But was there anything one should know about Raymond?
One should know. Well, I wrote a celebration of his life. I mean, it was first commissioned as an obituary by, I think, The Guardian, because they'd commissioned one from, I think, Maurice Bloch, and didn't like what he did at the time. So they asked for something a bit more human and less abstract. So I did them a version. And of course, Raymond didn't die. He reached 100. Well, since the way my mind works, I couldn't write another article. So I took the obituary off and transformed it into a present tense celebration of survival. In that article, I made some play with the fact that Raymond came from a Methodist family and briefly taught Methodist Sunday school in New Zealand. And I was playing with the idea that the sort of the inner Protestant ethic search for industry and perfection informed his life, even though he became officially secular rationalist and had no religious belief, and was rather proud of being a rationalist. And Raymond read this article, because he was around to read it, and said to me, "It's quite extraordinary how much you know about me." And he didn't. He left it at that. But the article finished with the thought that in his sobriety, he resembled, and his industry, he resembled his Methodist father, Wesley, more than he perhaps would have wanted to acknowledge. Well, this thought clearly worried Raymond, because about 4 months later, he said, "By the way, I think you ought to know that in midlife, I wasn't sober, and I actually came to have a drink problem and had to be medically advised to stop drinking." So that was interesting. It was unknown to me. I knew he used to smoke and had given up smoking. He also suggested that the ambience in which he sort of matured in Bloomsbury in the 1930s was a sexually rather freewheeling one, and that he now looked back on some of that with, I think, feeling that it wasn't a healthy life they were living.
Yes. Your account of that mixture of rationalism and Methodism is a very curious echo. When I first talked about him to someone who knew him well, which was Ernest Pritchard, he said, "Do you know what Raymond does on Sundays?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, he goes down to the local Methodist chapel and he reads them chapters of Malinowski. Because he's a rationalist, this is his text, but they is still this Protestant zeal," was what he was saying. That's exactly the picture he painted for me before I went.
Well, yeah, that all joins up because Raymond did become active in some, I don't know if it's the South Place Ethical Society, but it's some fairly aggressively rationalist group for a while, and continued to write from that point of view about religion. One of his last books is a sort of rationalist looks at religion. I once interviewed him for, I think, the National Sound Archives. We laid down some tapes there, and I asked him, how did fieldwork in Tikapia change you? And he said, well, it made me, in certain ways, he said, it helped me lose my Puritanism, because when I saw that it was possible to have much freer and easier sexual relations than, you know, the New Zealand Methodist world would have made me suppose, and to still grow up as kind of moral people, I was forced to reconsider my own prejudices. So I then asked him I asked him if he was lonely in Tikapia, and he wasn't going to be had. He said, how could I be lonely with 1,200 Tikapura around me? Besides, he said, there was so much to do. And I asked him, which was very cheeky of me, that I felt posterity and history and the 60s would make me, you know, make it essential for me to ask. I said, how did you get the detail about sexual conduct? And he knew what I was after, and he said, not by sleeping with anyone. I got it because the young men would come to my tent in the evenings and talk about these things. So,
Are there any people, academics or writers or thinkers outside either anthropology or the LSE who you think have had a great influence on you? Filmmakers, musicians, novelists, writers, or other academics in America, France, anywhere else?
Oh dear, what a big question. Well, I've always had a tremendous respect for Kurosawa's early films. I think particularly of Ikiru, a story of a man faced with terminal cancer who decides he's got to do one positive thing with his life. And that's a favourite film. Seven Samurai, I've always thought it was a great film, and Rashomon is obviously a very, very strong film. There's one person. I think Hannah Arendt, I had a kind of Arendt phase in which I read a lot of her stuff and thought that she was an interesting thinker who was not in the then current Marxist mould. I didn't quite realise where she was coming from, and I certainly didn't understand everything she wrote because she has a quite complex and idiosyncratic mind. But I thought the stuff on anti-Semitism and racism in late 19th century France was very powerful. And I don't know. I mean, I think I'm attracted to thinkers who sort of illuminate the bits of the world that I happen to be obsessed with. Primo Levi is powerful for me because from an early age I read about concentration camps and death camps. For some reason I read about them when I was about 8 years of age. The Nuremberg trials were on and I had learned to read, and I started reading trial stuff in the newspaper, and I couldn't understand it. It was too horrific. And so I would say to my mother, you know, they made lamps out of people's skins. And I can still remember the name of the wardress who had one of these lamps. She was called Ilse Koch. I think she was called the Beast of Belsen and so on by the press. And there were channels to take away rivers of human fat, things like that. So you read that at eight, and I think you return to it. So I read about Eugen Kogan's The Theory and Practice of Hell about Buchenwald. He was a German sociologist who analyzed it. I read Viktor Frankl, From Death Camp to Existentialism. I read Levi when I discovered him. these people aren't intellectual influences in the sense that you read them and it helps you kind of give the next lecture, or it helps you directly with the theory of a piece of work you're writing. But it seems to me that because I was forced professionally to consider war and dislocation as something that happened to my relatives, friends and key informants, and I was then forced to think about the history of Greco-Turkish relations, the end of the Ottoman Empire, and how much dissolution and disruption and forced migration, the end of empire and the rise of nationalism, those things going together. I'm drawn to thinkers who are thinking about the dark side, the non-systematic, the disrupted, all that stuff, which postmodernism bangs on about as if they've just discovered it, but of course they haven't. Every European intellectual who has been worried about these issues for the last several hundred years. But So Marx, when I read Marx, I always thought Marx was a powerful thinker. I still, if I'm asked to sort of have a label for myself, I would say, you begin with political economy. That's the foundation, whatever else you want to add in. As far as I can see, the whole discipline of economic history is footnotes to Marx. And they don't talk about it that way, but that's how the subject has developed, for God's sake. I don't feel myself to be an anthropologist über alles, or an echt anthropologist. I think of myself as a social scientist, and I want to write an article about the loss to anthropology of its turning excessively qualitative, and it's refusing to integrate with quantitative work. So that, in a sense, economic history was there for an alliance, and most anthropologists have run a mile from that. You're an exception. But the number of people who've used serious quantitative data in the last 50 years of anthropology and used it to any purpose is lamentably few, I think. And I think there's a real loss there, that they've set themselves too easy a task. I think exploring cultural differences and the semantics of culture is an easy task. They represent it as epistemologically difficult. I think it may be epistemologically a little difficult, but it's not the most impressive. It's not the thing that most needs to be done in the world we live in, you know. And if
you touched on two areas which I find very wonderful. One was this question of war and dislocation, which is the subject of your best books. It sounds as if you hadn't been reading Hannah Arendt and you thought, I must go and study something like that.
No, it's the other way around.
The other way around.
You get the problem and then you look for guidance. Mm. And I mean, look, Elizabeth Colson's study of the dislocation of the Gwembe Tonga to build the Kariba Dam, I mean, that's the foundational book for me, the best book I found that dealt with forced migration. And Peter Maris's Loss and Change was the other foundational book. I didn't realize then that Maris had got some of his insights from a psychoanalyst, Murray Parks. But I mean, we're all building on other people's insights, and in that sense, I do feel, we're involved in a cumulative task, not an individualistic one. And although, as individuals, we wish for distinction and recognition, the reality is, like the student of Mauss, I think, or Durkheim, who was sitting on a bus contemplating a lecture on the individual and society and suddenly saw that it isn't me against the others, or, you know, it's us, but we're a collectivity and we we help each other on. I think that's a terribly valuable lesson, and I don't think we make that sufficiently clear in our teaching, because we are too possessed by the spirit of individualism, the Protestant capitalist spirit. I think we should end on that note, as I now wish to go and visit a colleague who's in hospital.
We ought to pay tribute to the fact that you're one of the most important senior figures in
a small pool
of British experts on ethnographic film and so on. You went back to this to a certain extent. You haven't made many films, but you've been a film critic, really, and a guide.
I've made two films in Cyprus, which I'm responsible for. I was involved in a propaganda film in Cyprus that I would prefer to forget, but it seemed the right thing to do at the time. I recently shot a film in Bosnia about refugees returning to their village, been involved as an interviewer in films about Raymond Furth and Frederick Bart. And I re-edited a film for the Southwest African People's Organization and turned a very bad film into a slightly less bad film. So I've kept my hand in, because it's like, why not wanting to walk away completely from a part of your life? And I mean, film was the big love of my 20s. And still, I'm glad to say, reassurance in my 60s that, I mean, I'm still trying to see films that I first heard about 40 years ago. The case of Ichikawa's two war films 43 years ago. So, I mean, the cinema's a passion, and one would have liked to play, to do more, but...
One of the odd things is, you'd think it would be so useful in anthropology, anthropology teaching and PhDs and so on would have a film component, because it's such a visual subject, and yet it's sort of always on the edge, isn't it?
Well, in the middle of trying to write a book about film, I had a very sobering experience. I looked at the RAI's printout for film rentals in British universities, and it turned out that typically there would be one member of staff per department who was a frequent film user. And some of the absolutely wonderful films in the RAI library were only seen about three times a year. So I suddenly thought, I'm writing very laboriously a book for a very small constituency. And that was a bit depressing. But since then, practically every department in Britain feels itself compelled to put on a film that has a course that has film as a central issue. So... I think the tide's turning, and younger people grow up on television, and they're visually more literate. I mean, when I said to Raymond Furth, we want to do a film about you, he said, of course, we don't go to the cinema. And Frederick Bart said exactly the same thing. They regard the cinema as a sort of rather frivolous thing.
I remember hearing a story from... Stephen Hugh Jones, when they were watching, he went to see films in the 60s with Maya Fortes, and I think it was the Marshall film on the Bushmen.
Yeah.
And he remembered coming out with Fortes, and he said, he was very, very excited by this, and he said to Fortes, what do you think about this? And Fortes said, oh, film, never catch on.
I love it. Cut.